Welcome to Vox Lab, the podcast series of Precision Talks, and listen to the voices of the scientists working towards precision toxicology to better protect human health and the environment.
Welcome to this third episode of Vox Lab, the Precision Talks podcast. I'm today with Dr. Luisa Orsini, Associate Professor in Biosystems and Environment Change at the University of Birmingham in UK. Hello, Luisa. Thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure. Hi to you.
You are one of the researchers involved in the Precision Talks project. You work on Daphnia magna, a small planktonic crustacea that lives in freshwater, that is often used as a sentinel species in ecotoxicology. Luisa, can you explain how you became interested in this model? What makes it so special?
Well, let's see. I started my PhD in a marine environment, and then I was more fascinated with understanding how organisms evolve and respond to the environment. And so I started working on other model species like insects, Drosophila, butterflies. And then in 2008, I stumbled on this model system, and I was immediately fascinated. And one thing that distinguished this model from others is their ability to enter dormancy for an extremely long time. They can sleep for hundreds of years. And this is a huge advantage if you want to understand what are the molecular and physiological mechanisms of adaptation to environmental change, including climate change. You have to think that most changes do not happen overnight. And so having the possibility to actually follow changes as they happen by resurrecting these organisms back to life is a unique advantage that I call the evolutionary time machine.
Can you describe a bit more Daphnia? How do they live? What size they have? How do they reproduce? You explain us that they can be dormant for 100 years, even more. How do they get into this stage, the states of stasis or dormance, and what wakes them up, and how do you play on this?
Sure. So Daphnia, as you mentioned at the very beginning, is a small invertebrate crustacean, and you find it in almost 98% of freshwater ecosystem. There are different species of Daphnia, and the most common in Europe and the African continent is Daphnia magna. How this species in particular reproduce is via parthenogenetic life cycle. What this means is that in favorable environmental conditions, each female produces identical copies of itself, and that's the clonal phase. So this is an evolutionary advantageous position, because if there is no limitation of resources, you better just produce many copies of yourself, and then your population increases. However, when environmental conditions are less favorable, so think about short photo period, shortage of resources, transition to winter, for example. What happens is that females produce male copies of themselves, and then sexual reproduction occurs. Now, there is a key difference here. When they produce clonally and they have multiple copies of themselves, every brood can range between 15 and 25 individuals. Whereas when they reproduce sexually, the end result of that sexual reproduction is one dormant egg, which is encased in a chitin case that protects this recombinant embryo from the environment. And what happens is that it sinks at the bottom of lakes in sediment and then waits. So over winters until environmental conditions are favorable again. And that means temperature, photo period, availability of resources. So many of these dormant stages come back to life again, and they contribute to the genetic diversity of next year population. However, there are so many of them that not all have the chance to hatch again. And so that's an invaluable resource we can access. So we go back, we sample sediment, we can date it so you know exactly how old each population is. And then you can resurrect these populations of Nafnium from different times in the past. In the lab, by simply exposing them to light and temperature stimuli. So it's fascinating. If you see some of the videos that we created in the lab, it's like they all stopped at some point in the past. They had a number of cellular divisions, and then they pause all at the same time, like a very planned experiment. And then when you finally expose them again to the right stimulus, they start off where they left off before. And so they keep developing and they become fully functional adults. Now, the fascinating point here, once they hatch into adults, they can be kept as clones. And so that's a dreamland for a geneticist, because then what you have is an infinite resource. Then you can use in different assays. You can expose to different chemicals. You can obtain gene expression data, metabolic data, genome sequences, phenotypic assays. It's an infinite resource. Daphnia is a very exceptional model for you to distinguish between genetic and plastic response. And there has always been an interest in evolutionary biology to distinguish between these two, because there is a much contested evidence that either genetic evolution hinders plasticity or helps plasticity, but you can have it also the other way around. Plasticity can hinder genetic evolution or help it along.
What is plasticity exactly?
What is plasticity? So plasticity is essentially a reversible change in an organism's behavior or physiology in response to a cue from the environment. Let me give you an example. If you expose Daphnia to a predator, then the response could be the development of neck teeth. And this is happening without changing the genetic makeup of the organism. Another form of plasticity is if Daphnia magna is exposed to fish predation. Because fish uses visual cues, what happens is that Daphnia tend to become smaller, so it's less visible, and this way escapes. So there are behavior change, there can be phenotypic changes, but then what you can also observe is epigenetic changes, so non-genetic changes that allow this organism to respond very fast to environmental cue. And this includes chemicals as well. So that trigger of change at molecular level that you can see at transcriptome level or at epigenetic level is an example of plasticity.
With a team of researchers of several universities, you recently published an article entitled "The Time Machine Framework, Monitoring and Prediction of Biodiversity Loss Using Daphnia and AI. We can learn from the past to better protect biodiversity." Can you explain how, from a small organism like Daphnia, we can better protect the environment? How do you find this species that is dormant and analyze it through time?
So that framework that you just mentioned goes, in fact, beyond Daphnia. So what it uses is a system of, instead of resurrecting animals, it uses environmental DNA that is contained in sediment or biological archives. The principle is that you are able, using this ghost DNA left behind by communities, to understand how the biodiversity changed over time and how it correlated with changes in the environment. But so you understand that by doing this, you are able to identify correlation, say, between certain taxonomic groups and certain environmental factors. However, for you to understand what are the mechanisms that led certain species to evolve in response to certain environmental change, you need to work with live things. And so that's where Daphnia come into place, and it enables us to experimentally validate every hypothesis that we did based on the entire biodiversity, the entire community. And then that framework, in addition to enabling us to reconstruct the long-term patterns that led to present-day biodiversity changes, it allows also to learn from the past to predict the future. So we capitalize on artificial intelligence to learn from these long-term trends and then to project them in the future, considering all the biotic interactions, evolutionary changes, and so on, and then project predictions in different climate and pollution scenarios with uncertainty, but definitely an uncertainty that is lower than current models.
And for instance, do you have an example in particular of the results that you highlight?
So, for example, if you look at current climate models, so climate models only project changes in climate variables, and they assume species presence absence. What they do not take into account is how species interact with each other. Let me give you an example. If you are projecting if a butterfly species will survive, but you do not take into account the habitat in which it will live, and you forget to include that in the model, you might overestimate or underestimate the ability of that species to survive. If the habitat disappears, it doesn't matter if the butterfly is able to survive, if it doesn't have an habitat anymore. And the same principle is you cannot predict changes unless you take into account evolution. So nothing makes sense unless in the light of evolution. And that's the bottom line of that framework.
Now in Precision Talks, you are using this organism model, which is 3R compliant. We might explain what it means to for the people who are listening to us. But in Precision Talks, we don't use Daphnia for ecotoxicology, but to predict the effects of chemicals on human health. What makes it interesting to use Daphnia to understand human health? And what do they have in common?
So you might want to think about all the animal species as being part of a kingdom, right? And so they come from a common ancestor and they evolved from this common ancestor. So they have still many genes, molecular elements, networks of genes that are conserved evolutionarily across the species. And so this is what we use as a concept to understand how human health can be affected by chemicals. But here, what we do is to use different model species, and we understand the impact of chemicals on each one of them. And then we ask how many of these gene networks we have identified are shared among different species that could be phylogenetically close to each other or more distant. And based on this approach, you can understand what genes might be early warning system of toxicity, either in certain taxonomic groups, it could be only invertebrates, or across the entire tree of life. And that's where the power of this approach lays.
So in Precision Talks, we are going to test 250 chemicals during this 5 years project. How do you proceed exactly? How do you expose the Daphnia to the chemicals, and how do you monitor their reaction? How do you analyze the genomic transcriptomes? How does it work?
So I did mention that Daphnia is clonal. And so you have the advantage of creating populations from an individual genotype. And so what this allows you to do is to fix one of the variables, which is genetic variation among strains. And so we decided to use one strain in particular, for which we have a lot of genetic resources. We have a reference genome developed on it. We have transcriptome data, epigenetic, ATAC-seq, and so on.
And it is a natural strain.
Yes, it is a natural strain resurrected from a natural lake from recent years, so that there is no potential confounding factors due to the fact that the strains might have lived in a different past environment. And so what we do is to grow populations of this strain. And at specific developmental stage, we expose the population to different chemicals. And what we will be looking at in precision talks is one of a fitness or ecological endpoint, which is immobilization. You can think of it as mortality or inability to move anymore. And on clonal copies of these populations, we'll be collecting tissue from which we then expose RNA, extract RNA, DNA, and obtain then the molecular data that we following in the following phases, we will be matching with the phenotypic assay. So this is unique to Daphnia in the sense that if you're working with other model species, you cannot exactly match phenotype and genotype from exactly the same strain. Here you can do that, and it's unique.
Which animal do you think is the best organism species that we have in the project? Biased question.
It's a biased question, but I want to answer in a different way. So this project is unique because it uses the advantages of multiple model organisms so that for the first time you can create it, you can create a deep understanding of environmental and human health. And only by aligning these two, you can actually create new ways of dealing with the problem of pollutants in the environment.
And they are so 3Rs compliant. So we haven't explained what it is in this podcast. 3Rs stand for replacement, reduction, and refinement of animal experimentation. And we consider in the law those organisms as non-sentient. And so they are compatible with the replacement solution. We have to also explain that in toxicology at the moment, most experiments in regulatory toxicology are performed on rodents in particular. They are the golden standard, but this project is funded by the EU, the European Union, with the objective of replacing animal testing to accelerate safety assessment of chemicals. We will be testing 250 chemicals in this project. To understand the benefit of this organism, how many people work in your team, for instance, just on Daphnia, and how many people would we need to do the same experiments on rodent, just to have an idea?
Yeah, so first of all, so it's important that we stress that the organisms we work on meet the requirement for replacement, refinement, reduction. And that's one of the priorities for the EU that wants to move away from animal testing. The second point that you made is very important. So how long would it take us to do the same experiment on organisms that are now used as a proxy for mammals? It will take much longer time. We have to deal with ethics issue because they are sentient organisms and not necessarily they give us more information than we get here. So as I mentioned before, because of evolutionary conservational pathways, you can make sure that you are looking at conserved pathways for the impact of chemicals across different species. And that's much more informative if you just look at one species that is a proxy for humans. There is also the other aspect that if you want to test a large number of chemicals and their mixtures, which we will be doing, you would need probably 20 years and as many resources as for precision talks projects. So what we are proposing to do is to do it in an efficient way, in a more rapid way, at no cost for efficiency and accuracy. And in a way, with this project, we hope to demonstrate we don't need any more animal models, and we can definitely reduce the use of animal models in favor of non-sentient species.
And it will be also more precise. Can you develop that? The result that we would get with this five organism species compared, we have to also mention that human cell lines are also used in the project to test the models with the human results. So how is this project more precise and go to precision toxicology?
Precision toxicology is providing more comprehensive information, because as I mentioned, instead of looking at one proxy species that mimics humans, you are looking at species that are placed across the tree of life, and then you are comparing this to human cell lines. So what this allows you to see is whatever toxicity pathways are conserved evolutionarily across the tree of life, or might be relevant only to certain species. So it gives you the added information of what is a toxicity pathway with impact on environmental relevant species, as well as across all species. While these might not necessarily eliminate altogether toxicity tests on mammal species, it can definitely reduce those kind of exposures. So what we might end up finding out is specific pathways that are targeted for toxicity. And then what you can do is to use this information to reduce your animal testing to only the targets that are relevant for toxicity, rather than randomly testing mammal models.
What are the ecological endpoints that you are looking at?
There will be different ecological endpoints, the traditional ones that also current toxicology looks at, which is immobilization. So basically when you kill half of the population. But what we provide as a new perspective is measuring molecular endpoints. So these would be the toxicity pathways that are activated by chemicals. And by doing this at different times in the developmental phase, what you can get as an information is the early warning system. So instead of waiting for chemicals to kill half of your population, you might identify biomarkers, so-called molecular biomarkers, that can help you understanding if a chemical has an adverse effect way early before it causes harm to other species.
So you will be able to understand better and predict better the level of exposure that are harmful for human health and other species as well, right?
That's correct. Yeah, the key point here is instead of waiting for the chemical to be extremely toxic and killing animals, you can develop a system that allows you to spot that early on.
So it will help ultimately regulators to set better level of exposure in the low, for instance.
Yes. So trace contaminants, low levels can be toxic, but their effect is not detectable necessarily at the physiological level. But you can see it at molecular level at the very early stages.
And what is the level of regulatory acceptance or recognition of DAFNIA as a model in regulatory toxicology?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are kind of lucky because DAFNIA, especially DAFNIA magna, is one of the model species chosen by regulators to test adverse effect of chemicals. So the jump to accept what we are telling them is probably not as long as we think. However, the way DAFNIA is used by regulators is by looking at these ecological endpoints. So very drastic effects determined by very high dosage of chemicals. So where our work will be is in convincing regulators that there are more fine-tuned ways of identifying toxicity early on before we get to the point of killing animals and impacting human health in a harmful way.
And do you think there is a market for this, for the industry as well? What will be the impact for society and for business if we manage to accelerate and reduce the cost of regulatory testing?
I think there is a market. Reason for this is that we are, you know, looking at regulators becoming more and more aware of chemicals in the environment. And chemicals are generated by a number of production processes. including industrial processes. And then industry is increasingly made accountable for these chemicals. So unless they don't want to face large fines, they have to deal with the problem. And so if we give them a mean to deal with the problem early on, before they get fined, even if they just don't want to look at them, you know, their impact on the environment or their goodwill, at least if they look even at their economic profit or savings, it would be to their advantage.
What is the next step in your lab? Where are you at the moment in Precision Talks?
Well, my lab is contributing to the exposures of Daphnia to the first 50 chemicals. It's already a large endeavor. We are collaborating with different groups. We are on track with this, and it requires quite some effort. And I want to acknowledge all the fabulous people I work with, because that's a lot of concerted effort. It will not be an easy path, but we're working together. It's a great honor to work in this group, because there's a lot of extremely good scientists, and I am pretty confident we will deliver what we need to.
Thank you very much, Lisa. Is there something you would like to add as a conclusion?
I'm hoping that Precision Talks, like many other big projects funded by the EU, will be a breakthrough. So we'll change the way we think about human health and environmental health as compartmentalized things. If we want healthy humans, we need to have healthy environment. And so by putting them together and looking at them as an ensemble, we can find our way through. And it's the only way forward, in my view.
Thank you very much for sharing all this information and knowledge with us and your hope for the future. Thank you again.
It was my pleasure.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. To learn more about Precision Toxicology and listen to the new episodes of VoxLam, visit our website, precisiontox.org, and follow us on Twitter at @PrecisionTalks. This project has received the financial support of the European Union's Horizon 2020 program. The content of this program only reflects the author's view. The EU cannot be held responsible for any information contained therein.